did not hear from Commissioner Logan, and that's not even this, and well, I can welcome Councilman. He's now our liaison between Commissioner and Council. Can we report back all of this? We have things to say. Next item on the agenda is the secret minutes of our facilities. Do you all have a chance to read them? Is there a motion?
I would make a motion to accept the minutes that is drafted.
I'll second that.
The move is seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? None. And now we're in the business. We have a work session this evening to talk about small cell wireless facilities. And Mr. Lindsay Orders' presentation did for a shot and share your view first.
Good evening, Commission. It's my pleasure just to get us started on the wireless communication facilities this evening. I'm giving a really brief intro, and then I'm going to turn it over. As you know, we've talked about the wireless facilities at our last couple of meetings, and they kind of came about because of the new FCC regulations, which kind of limit the city's ability in a number of areas in our aesthetic guidelines that we can have, in how much control we can have over where they go, in the fees that we can charge, and in the time that we can take to approve the permits. So we have some new rules that we're dealing with, and that's kind of what started the ball rolling for the code amendments. And like I said, you have had a couple of briefings. You did see that first PowerPoint that Ogden Murphy Wallace did just about the FCC ruling. And then last month, I did sort of a hybrid presentation, some Ogden Murphy Wallace slides and some of ours, and a lot of photos of existing city streetlights and some examples of what small cell actually looks like. And in the past month, since that meeting, we've been working with the city attorney's office. And I would like to take this opportunity to introduce Alana Zana. She is with Ogden Murphy Wallace, and she's an expert. That's why I'm going to be turning the meeting over to her. And she not only works for the city, she works for many cities across the state and is a recognized expert in small cell facilities. So we feel really lucky to have her working for us. She's going to make us look good. I'm just going to give you kind of a brief overview. Essentially, all of our facilities are going to become administrative review and approval. Right now, the wireless facilities that we have are a conditional use. And one of the advantages to making them administrative, we're going to be able a lot more able to meet the timelines, the new timelines, because the timeline not only includes the planning review of the permit, but also the right-of-way permit and the building permit. All three of those components have to be done within the timeline. The new ordinance establishes fees, and these fees are really pretty much of a deposit because we can't charge any more than the actual costs. So we're going to have to be tracking city time. We'll get a deposit from them up front, and then either bill them for additional, depending on how long it takes, or we'll be refunding money if they haven't spent it all. And it also establishes appeals process. If the facility happens to be on private property, the appeal will be to the hearing examiner. And if the facility is in the right-of-way, then it has to go to Superior Court. And like I mentioned earlier, we used to have all of our wireless facilities under a conditional use, Chapter 1728. Part of these amendments will be to delete those wireless sections out of 1728, and we're adding a whole brand new chapter, 1729. The chapter is divided up into articles. Article 1 covers the purpose, definition, general provisions. Article 2 talks about the macro facilities. Article 3, eligible facilities requests. And essentially what that is, that's if somebody's making a change to an existing facility. And I think it's usually a macro facility, and they're just changing out the antenna. It's a shorter review. And that's why it's a different permit. And then Article 4 is small wireless facilities. And this does contain, like, the application, the procedure, the review criteria, design criteria, and how we handle modifications. And at this point, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Ms. Sana. And what I'd like to do, I've got the PowerPoint structure to take each article one by one. And I thought we could, you could address all your questions to Ms. Sana, and we could discuss Article 1 before we move on to another article, and rather than kind of bouncing back and forth. It might structure the discussion a little bit. So thank you.
Good evening. Thanks so much for having me out here today. So I think, as Sherry said, the idea is really a conversation where you have the opportunity to ask me questions, ask me about the code, and get a feeling of what have we designed here and what do we think that small cells are going to look like here in Mill Creek. So as Sherry said, we're going to go kind of article by article. I would expect that there are certain articles that you have more questions on than others. And so if I don't see questions or comments, then we'll move to the next slide and everybody can go home to dinner. So first one, Article 1, Purpose, Definitions, General Provisions. So this particular article is applicable to both macro and small cell facilities. It discusses what are the different elements of an application that would be required. So first of all, what's the purpose? What are we doing here? That's the first section. And then what permits are required? Is a lease required? For example, a lease would be required if using a city-owned asset. Is a franchise required? For example, a franchise would be required if you're using the right-of-way, which is where most small cells will be located, but not as many macros. And then long definitional section and just some general provisions on setting up the chapter. Are there any questions on Article 1? Questions, comments? I'll say questions, but that means anything you want to say. It is. I would agree. So macro facilities in the right of way.
I have a question.
Absolutely.
So let's see, page 5 of 33. So small wireless facility permit beyond the initial five, $100. Small wireless facility permit, newer replacement pole, $1,000 a pole. So would that mean if they have to put in, 10 poles, that's $1,000 per pole permit? Or if I'm applying for a permit for 10 poles, it's $1,000?
That's a great question. So these are, this $1,000 is what's considered a safe harbor in the FCC order. So the FCC has said, you know what, if they're going to put in a new pole, the city review time is really going to be about $1,000 to review that. And they did that on a per pole basis. However, I think you're right. If they're going to put in 10, is it really $10,000? And that's why Sherry was talking about this being a deposit. So yes, if it's $10,000 or $15,000, the city should come out even. Right? But if it's less than, say, $10,000, I think arguably the city should refund that deposit. Considering it's an FCC safe harbor, I'm not sure that they necessarily would be required to, but I would make the suggestion of refunding it. Use the money that you spend. This is not a moneymaker for the city. At the same time, if this also involves the lease of a city-owned asset, then you maybe it might take more time to review it, make sure it doesn't interfere with other things that the city-owned asset wants. For example, it doesn't interfere with street lighting. So it really is a cost-based idea, and this is the safe harbor for that.
And then, thank you. And then also, so the C is for the facility permit, per pole and then a new pole. So would it be, let's say, just hypothetically so I can get this straight in my head, one new pole with a wireless facility on it, is that $1,100?
No, $1,000.
It's $1,000. The pole includes the permit.
Yes. So C is beyond the initial five on existing poles.
Gotcha. Okay. Yes. Thank you.
My pleasure. I'm moving on to Article 2, unless there's further questions.
I just have a question on, so in the definition section of Article 1, so in A, for antenna, we've got the provision of personal wireless service. And then that is echoed in H under service provider where it says personal wireless services. But in F, macro facility, it says coverage for a cellular telephone network. Is there a difference? And I'm just in my splitting hairs here and just trying to understand.
So I think you put out a good point here. I don't see a difference, but I think that somebody one day might say maybe there's a difference. And so the term personal wireless service is more of a term of art. It's used in the statutes. And so I would actually say let's move the definition of macro instead of say cellular telephone network to personal wireless service. To be consistent, exactly. All right. Article 2, macro facilities. So we start, again, application requirements. This is what we need to know if you're going to apply for a macro facility. And then the next is, here's the procedure we're going to use when we are looking at a macro facility application. As Sherry mentioned, we're discouraging CUP at this point. We're using an administrative permitting process. So it's a much more streamlined process. It's not necessarily going to the hearing examiner. We then go into review criteria for macro facilities. How are we going to evaluate them? And then prioritized locations for those macro facilities. This one's an important one. And so I'm going to pause there for a second. And what this one does is it says, if you're going to build a macro facility, this is where we want you to build it first and go down each of these items as a preference for the city. It doesn't say you have to build it on an existing macro structure, but you have to show us why you can't, why that won't meet your needs. So it's a priority, and it expresses, it's a way for the city to control both design as well as your streetscape and your landscape. So with macro facilities, it can be quite big, and it actually depends on the topography. So I can't tell you, hey, for T-Mobile, if you place it here, this will be their coverage. I don't know. It will actually depend on each carrier's needs, and the topography of the area. So if you're dealing in high ground, which is typically where most cell towers are, you're going to have larger coverage. But at the same time, you may not have enough capacity. So this particular piece is macro. Small cell, which we'll get to later, has a much smaller coverage area. Macro can have really a pretty big coverage area. And it also depends on how many people are using it in terms of capacity. So this macro facilities is the existing system today. So that's what this is designed to deal with. I would expect you're going to see more macro facilities in the future.
A lot of this is what we used historically to review our conditional use permits, but it now is being codified in its own section.
I believe that's true.
Yeah, we didn't change the priorities. Those carried over because they were working for us previously pretty well.
So that will be when we get to the small cell, yes. In macro, I have not heard that they're going to be requiring their own system and their own poles. It will continue to be co-location. And that's continuously what I'm seeing, honestly. When I deal with macro leases, I am still seeing co-locations on macro leases. So I don't expect that to change. Can't guarantee it.
So
yes.
Along those lines, in under the application requirements, in number 8, why do we have just a statement demonstrating that there's been a reasonable attempt to find co-location rather than demonstrating that there's, you know, just Because I could just see, right, let me check this box. Yes, we tried to find co-location.
So we can absolutely make it broader. I think, we went back to what was originally there. But we could say here, you must provide a technical demonstration. What we need to veer away from is the old tests. So there was a test we used up until this year called significant gap in coverage and then least intrusive means. Those were the tests in the Ninth Circuit. The FCC really did not like the Ninth Circuit, and if you read the recent order, they absolutely said the Ninth Circuit test, which is where we are, does not apply. We're done. It's out. Now, there's an appeal happening right now in the Ninth Circuit, so hopefully, I really do hope, they'd say, no, you cannot throw out a decade's worth of case law, but I don't know that for sure. So one of the issues we have is trying to draft this, not knowing where the case law is going to land in the next 5 years, next 5 years. We can beef eight up a little bit more to say, hey, you got to show us that you've really had a good faith effort here.
Well, it seems that you could just couple the image number 7, documentation showing that the applicant is making reasonable attempt. That doesn't clearly define the test, right?
But at least it provides documentation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, and mainly I assumed that it had probably something to do with the new regs from the FCC, that it was probably like, okay. And I'm not one to be, try to be overly obtrusive or anything. But at the same time, I don't like the kind of, check the box. Did you, something as important as this. Yeah, sure, yes, we tried.
I think that's fair. So the note I personally wrote was combine number 7 and take technical capabilities and physical problems. So I would beef it up a little bit more than just 7. And perfect. Then we'll put that in. I think that there is still a level of subjectivity here. And just as a side note, if you walk away from this meeting and you're thinking about it later and you're like, I really think this revision would be helpful, just shoot us an email. We're happy to take a look at it also. All right, we went through prioritized location. We then created these design and concealment standards. I believe most of them were also still from the original code, just recodified over here. And then expiration of a macro facility permit. So the point of that is actually really important, and it gets to, hey, we just don't want these permits sitting out here forever. We're going to give you a permit. Go out and build. And then appeals. So we deal with the appeals and say we're going to be processed pursuant to Title 14. And as we talked before, we're fixing Title 14 to make it clear. I'm on page 14. So page 11, that 60 days, is if there's a sale, transfer, or an assignment of the macro facility.
So if they get, some places said if they get a permit and don't exercise it, they do a period where it becomes.
On page 14?
It's 3 years.
That's 3 years. Correct. And they can have a one-time extension for 12 months. Yes.
So on that, so 172900A, expiration of macro facility permit. So in the last line there, it says, so with one extension limited to 12 months, if the applicant cannot construct the small wireless facility.
Macro facility.
Thank you.
Any further questions on the macro facilities?
Yes. So on, oh, no. We're moving on to, yeah, no. Eligible facility requests.
All right. Eligible facilities requests. This particular chapter is mainly taken from a template from the National League of Cities and the National Association of Telecommunication Officers. So I've made very tiny changes to it, but for the most part, we've plugged it in. And for the most part, it follows federal law, almost identical, including some grammatical issues that exist in federal law. So I'm going to acknowledge in advance that that exists, but we wanted to stay as close as possible to the actual federal law. And what eligible facilities requests do is as exactly what Sherry said before in her introduction. It's the idea that they want to make a modification. It's not a substantial change, and I put quotes there because that's a definitional term. And the city has 60 days in which to approve the permit for an eligible facilities request. If they don't, then it is deemed approved. So if you don't act, the FCC has taken away all your ability. By the way, though, good luck denying these. So it will be very difficult to deny an eligible facilities request. Basically, the only way to deny it is if it is determined to be a substantial change. So this is written very much in a, you are going to approve this permit, or it is deemed approved. If we talk about fairness, right, I think we can realize that the FCC is not friendly to cities. So it's just not fair. It's not going to be fair for here, and it's not going to be fair for small cell. I'm just putting that out there. Unfortunately, though, this is what the FCC rules require, and so that's why I've got it codified here.
One thing I might add, I mean, not to be counter to what you just said, but if it really is substantial, and if all they're doing is opening a box and changing a little antenna or something like that, we don't want to get in their way. We all use our devices, and we're trying to streamline the process and make it easy for them to do their jobs so we can do ours.
I absolutely agree with that. Switch out, that's fine. But I will say I've seen eligible facilities requests that can be larger than what might have been initially thought of with eligible facilities requests when it was passed. That is what the rules are.
So, two questions. In Section A there, I know this is some jargon, and I just want some education here. What is unlicensed wireless services?
Great question.
It appears a few times here, and I'm like, okay, I get an idea what wireless communication services are, and fixed wireless or in microwave backhaul, I can imagine what that is, but what is unlicensed? That sounds very ominous and spooky that unlicensed wireless services is written into the code.
So I don't know that I can give you a good definition of unlicensed wireless services. I know that eligible facilities requests apply to radios, so like radio broadcasts as opposed to cell, what we think of traditionally as radio, although I think they're actually licensed, but I know that they're actually licensed. So I don't know specifically. I can look at it.
That's
a new one. And I did notice.
No, I'm not worried.
I did notice a typo in A that we'll fix.
And then the other question, and I don't know if this, I don't want to be too nitpicky, and I don't know if this is part of the grammatical things that you were referencing, but in paragraph C there, it says supports or houses equipment described in paragraph I and II above. Well, I went 4 pages back, and I couldn't find an I or
II. And it should be A and B.
Okay. All right.
Sorry.
I practiced law for 11 years and drafted and read a lot of contracts, so part of this is just reading and going through and like, hey, believe me, I've been in the, you know, so that just want to make sure, though, that I'm not reading it wrong.
No, and I appreciate this. I hope to catch these before I come to commission, but.
I've had way worse and way more embarrassing issues come up in front of clients or courts that this is minor stuff.
Any further questions on eligible facilities requests? Then we're going to get to the fun part. This is the fun part. Did we make a change? Is that why?
Oh, you sent it to me. And so that's different from what was in their packet. That's
oh, I see. Okay. Okay. Which typo?
In section A, you mentioned there was some typo you were going to fix.
Yes. If you look at A, it says definition, it kicks to section 1925-170. It should say 1729-120. That was my typo. Okay. So small wireless facilities. So we start again with this concept of an application process. And we go through in a lot of detail, honestly. I want to focus on E. So we go into a lot of detail here as to what are we requiring of the applicants. So this is where it's, hey, don't just check the box, right? We want a lot of information here. We actually are going to, so typically when you think about a right-of-way use permit, you don't see, unless they're excavating, so I guess in Mill Creek you see a fair amount of it, but you don't see physical construction drawings all the time, right? I'm going to take a wire, I'm going to string it from PSE pole A to PSE pole B, done. No, this is a different story. We want real construction drawings here. We want to know what are you doing, where are you doing it, and how does that affect everything else? And when we talk about everything else, we're not just talking about the electrical facilities and the backhaul wireline facilities. We're talking about ADA compliance. We're talking about photometric analysis if you're going to move one of our light poles, because we have to make sure that traffic still runs and we don't have blind spots. So there's a lot of components that going into siting a small cell facility. This is why it gets so much more specific here in the application. The other reason why this application process is so specific is because the FCC threw in a doozy of a sentence just out of nowhere in their rules, which was, if you are going to tell an applicant that their application is incomplete, you need to cite to the rule that they failed to meet. As opposed to typically you could say, hey, the permit required you to answer this question. I have to have it in the rule. So it's made it that much more difficult. So that's why we've really gotten into much more nitty-gritty than you'd see in normal permitting language in a code.
So what I'm hearing is that the telecommunication industry's lobbying is more powerful than the city of Mill Creek's.
More powerful
is that what I'm
than
hearing?
The cities of 50 states. Yes.
Every city added up.
Yes. Yes. I'm not biased. But
I am.
No, it is. And I will say that on behalf of many cities, I filed comments at the FCC on multiple occasions about the small cell rules. And there are, as I said, appeals going on right now about these rules. But the FCC had an agenda. And to their credit, right, their idea is we want to increase infrastructure and the ability for our cell phones and to work so that we can have, you know, self-driving cars and we can text and drive and all those wonderful things. Yes, yes. So I get the point. I just don't think they got there in the right way. Okay, so big application process here. And then
this application process is not counter to, like, they didn't say you can't include. I was reading through this and I was like, wow, okay, well, there must have been some leeway in there to say, okay, our application process can ask at least for lots of detail.
We got pretty specific because they made that one-liner out of nowhere, really out of nowhere, because all their commentary didn't talk about that. You had to actually just read the rule. But no. What the FCC said is you cannot materially inhibit deployment. Now, if an applicant were to come and say, hey, your request that we analyze ADA compliance will be a materially inhibition, I'm going to say good luck proving that, right? That's not so easy. So has this application process ever been tested? No. We're in a new world here. Is this the same as other cities in Washington State? Several other cities.
Is it like any other city that's actually started the small cell deployment? Like where it's actually applications have been in?
So to my knowledge, applications have only been processed in this area, kind of, well, only been processed in Seattle, Bellevue, and Burien. I've heard that Spokane, I've heard some maybe Tukwila and Tacoma, but I don't know for sure. Those three cities I know for sure.
And are there any cities elsewhere in the country that it's already done and they're starting
to? Yes. They like the East Coast better than us. East Coast, Texas, Florida, California, they're seeing more. I heard there was some in Vegas. So, yes. So next paragraph, 1729-200, we've got our review criteria. What are we looking at?
Oh, wait, can we
yes.
go back? I'm sorry.
Absolutely.
So in the one prior, so E4, page 20, so any application for small wireless facility located in the right-of-way adjacent to parcel zone for residential use shall demonstrate that the applicant has considered the following? How do you demonstrate that I've considered it? Yeah, I considered it. And I decided, what the hell?
We could tighten up the language a little bit. And I will also say this language is kind of unique to Mill Creek. There's a couple other cities that have it, but not all of the cities I work with have it. So the idea is, if you think about a house, and I'm going to use my house as a really good example because they built it beautifully in terms of the where the utility poles are. So in my house, I have my windows out to the street, and I have a utility pole to my left that as I look out the window, I have to look to my left. Right? It doesn't block the view of my street. And then I have a pole all the way further down to my right. So also, I have to look now to my right. It's not smack in the middle of my view. So that's what this is dealing with, right? Have you considered how you're going to affect someone's view? Because I do think that somebody considered that when they built my house. Somebody considered, where are those utility poles? Or when they built the utility poles, they considered, where are the house windows? And so that's the purpose here, is have you thought about these issues? Now, we could tighten up the word considered, which is what I think you're saying.
Yeah, because it's like, yeah, okay, I considered it, and I realize if we put it here, this is now going to be in this person's view. Yeah, I considered that.
So,
but too bad for them. It's better for the greater good, and therefore we're going to put it here.
You potentially could. And so I will say, based on that, there's been several cities that have actually chosen not to adopt four because, A, they're worried about people coming and saying, hey, now I've got three view poles blocking my view, and you didn't really do anything about it, maybe because the city couldn't. Also, the problem that does exist is if you move to another pole, you may affect another neighbor. Right? So you're just kicking the can down the road. So I will say that that is why there are some cities that have pulled four from the template we use.
I mean, you mentioned the photo metric, you know, looking at, but I thought in here, one, we say use an existing pole, and when I read that, I assumed that meant physically the same location, other than like ADA issues, moving it left or right, keeping the sidewalk unblocked. But we may want to look at tightening that up, because if you're saying, hey, you can move it enough to adjust the lighting standard, or you can have three in front of the house, I didn't read how you would get there.
So it would be difficult to have three in front of the house necessarily just because of where the poles are. But let's think about it this way. Have you ever seen two poles next to each other? Right? You drive down the street, you see the two wooden poles next to each other. I use pens a lot because a pen actually looks like a small cell, which I'll explain later when we talk about pictures. But anyway, typically, you can't cite a pole, especially, well, any pole. If you have a wooden pole, then you cite another wooden pole right next to it. It doesn't go back into the same spot, and the reason is you have to transfer the electrical and telecommunications off that pole, and you can't cut them, so you got to transfer it, and then you can get rid of the pole. So it is never, even if it's a replacement pole, it's never in the exact same spot. So that will depend on the foundation, and I think you use concrete poles, so you have a concrete foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are concrete, but there's an assortment.
Right. So it'll depend. What I've been told from other cities is depending on the foundation, if the foundation is hollow, then yes, you could probably pull up and put something new. If it's not, though, then you are going to have to move it. And the question is, where do you move it? And that's going to depend on the underground infrastructure, ADA compliance, photometric analysis, and where can you physically get a spot within the ground to put it.
For the PD poles, most of them are underground fed with electricity, and they don't carry other utilities on them. So I think in a lot of those cases, the replacement pole may pull, even if it has to pull the old foundation out, they could probably drop the... But again, PUD's going to have to be involved in this, and we have some meetings scheduled with them in the future. We can ask more specific questions, so we don't have exact answers.
I understand the utility overhead, the owner, but I think if we want light poles, we wouldn't want the foundation base sitting there either, and those can be removed. So, you know, I'd want to keep our coat tight on that spot and say, that's your problem. You've got to redo the foundation. You need either you put it in to take the size of it.
And that was the way when I, but yeah, I'll look for that as I go through. That was my interpretation, was physically same location, not, you know.
And I don't remember where we necessarily deal with it in this code, but I'll make a note of that. The idea is it really should be as close as possible to that original location.
What is the impact of the cities that removed number four? No applications in a residential area?
There have been almost no applications, period, and other than those cities that I mentioned earlier. So we don't know yet. I would expect applications in a residential area.
Could I add one thing also? We were talking about the word considered wasn't strong enough, but if you look at A and B following it, it tells you as you consider it, they have to prove that technical feasible alternative location exists. So it's not just considering and check the box. I think that they would have to convince city staff, if we keep four, that there is no technical. So I think it does give a little more teeth in the A and the B that follows that initial statement.
Again, I think there is a question of whether or not you want to keep four, because you could have a domino effect. Okay.
You know, another comment maybe against four is that if it's all administrative and ministerial, there's really not a process for the person to, like a neighbor, to complain once you issue the permits, the permit's issued. So
right.
that would put the city in a really odd position. If you've done it, someone starts to argue with you about it, you've already issued your permits.
That's true. So I don't have an objection to moving forward, not that I get a vote necessarily, but...
Does the Planning Commission have a feeling or a consensus on four? Maybe we should pull it out, or do you want to think about it some more?
Well, I sort of liked it. I'm trying to think of a residential location that has, you know, a wooden utility pole with wires overhead and a street light, and I can't immediately come to mind.
Yeah, that's how.
And so I'm.
I don't see any poles.
We have a lot of them in the annexation area, like the areas that are. Annex don't have the underground utilities, and we still have wooden poles with some street lights actually attached to the wooden poles.
But wires not strung. A separate one, not a separate street light pole and then a wooden pole, and in this case...
Some are combined.
I think there are. In fact, we run into that just in my business. I think there are a few of those around.
Not in the original Village Green Loop, the original Mill Creek, no. But in the areas that we've annexed over time, it is more common.
General consensus on four, or you want to get back to me on that? So let's just keep it for now and think about it and let it, you know, let's also see what the carriers have to say. So just as a note, the carriers are going to comment. They're going to send in letters with comments. And typically what we do as staff, and myself as the attorney, is we go through those comments. Some of them are very reasonable. Some of them are the typos you'd found. Sometimes they find those too. So some of them, we look at them and like, yeah, you know what? That makes sense. Some of them will say, no, that doesn't make sense. We don't want to add that. And some of them will kick to Planning Commission sometimes. Depends on those questions. Or they will send a letter directly to you because they don't like the answer we've given.
So. They'll be at our hearing, I'm sure.
They will absolutely be at the hearing. Yes.
I have a question on the sixth there. So assuming that when they do their study or whatever, they say, okay, you know, whatever the radio signal or frequencies come out, the radiation, does that account for an overlap of signal? Because I'm sure these things aren't just, you know, there's one here, and yeah, okay, I'm standing in front of this thing, that's fine, I'm not going to get, you know, whatever might happen. But at some point, the one next to it, you know, they're overlapping, so you don't have a gap in coverage. What if I'm sitting in that sweet spot? Is that also considered? I don't know about.
That's a really good question. I tell you, it came up in another city as well. I don't have the answer yet, but I will ping the carriers and see if they can come up with an answer to that. I don't know. But it is something that I've heard in another city as well recently. Correct. And the E should not be capitalized. Okay, so we go to review criteria. This is what we're going to be looking at when we look at a small cell. And then permit requirements. So we talked about this a little bit before, but, you know, what's the permit time limit? How long do they have to build out? When do we expect them to be operational? 220 and 230 talks about what happens if you want to make a modification to a small cell. When do you have to pull a small cell permit? And I use small cell and small wireless interchangeably. When do you have to pull that permit versus when can you just go in and get a building permit or a right-of-way permit and you don't have to go through the long application process? So kind of like what we talked about with the eligible facilities request, apply to small cell. If all you're doing is going into your equipment cabinet, opening it up, putting a radio in, we don't need a new small wireless facility permit for that. However, if your truck's in the right-of-way, you have to pull a right-of-way permit because you're going to be blocking traffic. That's the type of thing that we're dealing with in 220. 230, it's a little bit of legalese there. It says, hey, this is a consolidated permit. It's a land use and a right-of-way permit in one. 1729-240 is a hierarchy. So we talked about this on the macro facilities of our preferential locations, and that's what we have here. So we say, if a light pole exists within 150 feet of a wooden pole, use the light pole, unless you can't, for technical feasibility or aesthetic reasons. So if you come to me and say, look, if I use that light pole, that thing's going to be so big and so ugly, and it's not going to match your design standards. We really want to use the wooden pole. We're going to say, yes, you can use the wooden pole. So that's the hierarchy we've put in here. The director.
So can these things be on those concrete poles?
Yes.
Are you talking about the ones with PD poles?
The exposed aggregate, the... Yeah, those I. Those
so,
are,
the,
right. Those, they'll those be replaced. Have to go, right? Well, so eventually, is it reasonable to think that eventually those will all be replaced?
If you, I don't know. I think technology is going to change again by then, for Mill Creek. Mm-hmm. Honestly. Yeah.
If we look at this section and we say, you know, you have the street light pole and the wooden utility pole, that's kind of that situation that we have on the annexation areas. So I'm going back to the 4A and B.
That's kind of where we're saying, hey, you'd go on the streetlight pole, you wouldn't go on the wooden utility pole, which I think is what we want them to drive them to do. And I don't know how you get to two in front of one house, but I like the protection that 4A and B offer.
So then we move to 250, where we talk about these decorative poles. So you have in your light standards decorative poles that look something like, yeah, we'll get to it. There we go, like this. These are what we're calling your decorative poles. And so we're saying we really don't want you on these poles. We're not prohibiting you from them, but we really don't want you on them. So that's what 250 says. And then we're going to get down further, and we're going to talk about the test to get onto one of these poles.
So can I make a suggestion then?
Yes.
Can we change the city desires to discourage to...
City discourages. Yes.
But we do desire to discourage.
I really want to say no. Well, you know what? I'm just going to say no.
We will discourage.
I will discourage that. It's a little bit, it's not as good as we won't let you, but it's still.
So and why? Because we saw some at our last meeting. We had some of those concepts where it was like, okay, the thing basically looked like that with, you know, 10 more feet on top. And I'm like, oh, that doesn't seem so bad.
Well, I'll tell you.
So why aren't we discouraged? Yeah, like that. I'm like, I'd rather have that than a lot of other things.
Well, the city has invested, and we're the ones that own these poles. The other ones are owned by the PUD. Okay, so we don't want to be in the process and deal with the administration switching out these poles, which would take a lot of work. They're also, we don't have a whole lot of them. They've been picked to be inside the towns. They're in three places. They're in Town Center, they're in the North Point neighborhood, they're in the East Gateway, and they also kind of run up Main Street and a few other spots that are kind of connected to the Town Center. So if we could avoid using these, I think from administrative and the cost of us doing business, we'd like to stay away
from
them.
That makes sense. Okay.
I read the code is if it works out appropriately for us, and they're going down Bothell Avenue because that's probably where they're going to want to go. They're not going to go on the wooden poles that PUD's got. I've got a question here about if they go on their monopoles or big metal ones. But then ideally they'd be replacing the standard washed-out street light with something that looks like similar to this but has the antenna on the top. So we get a win out of this thing.
We're going to talk about it a little bit later, but and we haven't figured out the exact replacements yet, but we hope to have our standard plans that if you're putting a small cell on this type of a pole, let's say it's the aggregate concrete, we want you to use this pole and have them already pre-agree that yes, that works for us. If you're going to go into one of these poles, like if they have to, we're going to have sort of something picked out that looks similar that won't be look really bad. So we're not there yet. That we'd like to bring that back at a later date, that we still need some more work on that part of it.
But that would be the longer-term goal, is to have something aesthetic like this, take that design, move it into some of the neighborhoods.
We'd like to have some certainty so that the city knows what we're going to get, they know what they have to do, and so the process, the 60 days or whatever the time is, isn't a problem. We're not opening up manuals and trying to pick out a poll and then come with a different answer every time.
We need PUD to stop these things.
Exactly. A lot of players.
Well, and these are typically more expensive. So, it's just, well, I think this is actually your poll.
Yes.
So, we are, as Tom said, we are discussing, you know, what do we replace this with? I don't know that the goal was necessarily to replace it with the ornamental style. But what's the new kind of standard style?
And so, from a height standpoint, is, like, would, what, the replacement for that would be something similar,
the
plus on top.
I think these are 35.
Some sort of antenna then further above the light.
Yeah. So assuming these are about 35-foot poles somewhere around there, then you would see.
Can I ask why we couldn't go to an ornamental style? The incremental cost on that, you can't.
So I think A, the cost. B, PUD might not be willing to do that. C, that might look really strange, honestly. So, again, we're not talking about huge density in Mill Creek. I don't know what technology will bring. You're right, it'll probably go down Bothell Everett Highway. But you might end up with five poles that look like this and then one of those green poles then in the middle. And that would look very, in my opinion, strange.
Yeah, I think staff was in the residential areas. We were not calling attention to our utilities. They kind of blend in. And so I think in my mind, we haven't picked one out yet, is that the concrete aggregate would probably end up being replaced with sort of a dull satin-finished metal pole of some kind that wouldn't need to be painted over time, that would sort of look the same now as it does 10 years from now.
It
kind of blend in with the gray sky and sort of...
Something like that.
Yeah, something more like that. But and then more of where we're trying to call attention to the infrastructure, like in Town Center, we've got ornamental, and you're kind of going for that. But that's not really throughout the rest of the residential area.
We put poles that look like pine trees with plaster in El Dorado County going up on the top of it. And out of safety, you cannot see where the difference is between the big trees and the real trees. And just, that would be the promise.
And if you go to San Diego, they're like palm trees. And so, yes. These are going to have lights on it. You're going to see. These you're going to see.
Those palm trees do. Can I ask you the question about this picture in particular? Can you see it covered in the code anywhere? Yeah. We talked about line of sight being an issue for these small wireless antennas. And when you drive around town, it seems that, and maybe it's missing somewhere, maybe it's included somewhere else, but there doesn't seem to be a study or a provision for how much trimming and tree removal there might be because of this.
Yep.
And it could be a huge impact just because of the line of sight issues. As you drive up 164th Seattle Hill Road, Village Green Drive all the way around, where does that get looked at?
There are two spots. One is when you look at the application process, we do require under B to tell us about the specific trees and a landscaping plan for protecting, trimming, removing, replacing, and restoring any trees. Page 19. The second place, and just by way of background, I've been doing Mill Creek's franchises for probably the last decade, is that you have a paragraph in your franchises about tree trimming that discusses what is allowed and not allowed by a franchisee. Now, that being said, you're right, we haven't dealt with small cell and kind of the line of sight in the trees. However, typically, you're not seeing street trees as close to the right-of-way as these poles are. And maybe in the residential.
Yeah, certainly in the residential.
Okay.
Ferns and the yeah. Streets.
But the pole.
As you curve up 164th alone, just thought of this as I came down, there's not a line of sight that's going to be more than a few hundred feet in some areas. And it could be problematic because it's a big part of the draw of driving through town. You start trimming everything back just to make this happen. And we've been told this is going to happen.
This is going to happen. Let me look again at the application piece here, and we can think about that a little bit more. It is a unique question for me to hear about street trees. Typically, their line of sight is about 300 to 1,000 feet, so we're not going to go too far over, but also, where they're, well, it depends. As I say, where they're headed is they want to be street focused or pedestrian focused.
One of the unique things about Mill Creek, and I think this is one of the geniuses of the design, is that most of the streets curve. They're just not straight lines built on a grid, which is very frustrating working for the fire department, by the way. But it's a wonderful place to drive around. You know, my wife says when she drives, turns left on Village Green Drive, she goes, "Oh, I'm home." There's not a line of sight. There's going to be line of sight issues in the neighborhoods, for sure, in the residential areas. Yeah.
I think it's important, and I will personally agree with you. I took my family up here. We live in South Seattle, and I wanted to come to your parks because it was so beautiful up here. Okay, so I put a note.
Can I dive in on the poles again one more time? I did this last time, and I think on Village Green Drive, I said we should get the MCCA involved. I think if we have two pole styles along Village Green Drive, that could be problematic. And I know the wireless carrier is not going to like it, but they might have to put in all poles so they're consistent even if they're not in use. I'm just throwing that out again because then we'll have two pole styles possibly.
Village Green Drive is not one of the. Not
you had the Village Green Drive photo up.
Aggregate.
Okay. It's the aggregate poles.
Okay. Oh, I went the wrong direction. Okay.
So I'm just wondering if we have two pole styles along Village Green Drive. I know they're PUD-owned poles, but this could be very interesting if there are two pole styles now along Village Green Drive. I don't know about the city-owned poles like in Town Center. If we want two pole styles, I could see that maybe not being an issue, but I wonder if this would be. And getting the MCCA involved, I think, is very important because if a wireless carrier pops up a brand-new pole, it looks similar, but it's not the same. I'm wondering if that's going to be an issue along Village Green Drive.
Well, I think that we're going to have to talk to them and communicate with them,
sure.
But they are in the right-of-way, and I don't think they have actual control. I mean, it's certainly the communication that needs to be had. I don't, Lonnie, she can answer this, but I don't think we would have the authority to make them replace all the poles if they're not using them. Or not plan for their facility. So
I understand
that
all that. Yeah,
that's why city.
I'm throwing it out, though.
But we need to communicate clearly and let people know what the expectation is going to be.
Sure.
That's kind of to my question. I mean, when we talked about this in the past, and we said, "Hey, three carriers, 150 feet," that meant
basically every pole on Village Green gets replaced, and could we go to a more architectural style pole in the long run where it changes the look and feel of the road, or are we going to go and you know, as Alana just showed, go to the more of the steel pole that's taller and, you know. Well,
that's a matter of taste. I think these poles are the ugliest thing in the city. Ugh. That's one way of putting it. Oh, that is awfully ugly.
Obviously do not live in South Seattle.
But the one thing I will say that these poles generally get right is that they're just gray and you don't generally notice them. Right. You only notice the cedar fence that's brand new or been stained. The one that's been around for 10 years is just grays out, and you just don't really see it anymore.
Yep.
So I would prefer that whatever pole ends up being on Village Green Drive is just something that disappears into the background, not decorative, not ornamental, not colored. Then you see it.
Yes. So, I don't know. But I say that with a caveat of the city doesn't have the right to regulate this issue. So it's purely regulated by the FCC, and as long as they meet the FCC requirements, you cannot deny the permit on that basis. You can sue the federal government. So I will say, in many cities, the public will come for public comment and public hearings and say, hey, this is going to give my kids cancer. I mean, that I've sat in meeting after meeting where that's the discussion's happening. I'm not an RF expert. All I can tell you is what the law is.
So fully deployed, will these also affect, in the subdivisions?
Oh, yeah, these will be in the subdivisions, too.
Pole two houses down from me in Cottonwood, right?
Yeah.
And we're going to need one of those if I'm
going
to drive my car home or my car drive me home.
Again, I don't think the density in Mill Creek will be the same as, say, Bellevue or Seattle. But you will notice them. You will see them. Yeah. And then they will blend, and your kids will not notice them, just like you don't notice these poles, unless you're my children, in which I say, spouse out. But... So it'll eventually blend into the background. And they are working towards trying to figure out how to make them blend better. I mean, I think this is one of the better pictures I've seen, and I just saw this today. It's a photo sim. I have questions about if this is even practical because they're putting their equipment inside, and I think that what you're not seeing is the diameter of this pole. I think the diameter is much bigger. But if this is something they truly can do, this doesn't give me a lot of angst. So that's one design that they've been showing us recently. Here's another. This is the one they're proposing in Kent. So here you see the equipment on the exterior, but the advantage of that is that you don't have the big base blocking the sidewalk. So you get the exterior, and then you asked earlier about the antenna up on top. There's your antenna up on top.
No, that red stripe is pointing to the antenna. It's just that little...
The can.
What I consider ugly box in full height where all the utility is.
It absolutely does. And the problem will be is hiding that box. So it's a give and take. If we say that box has to be internal to the pole, you end up with a much wider diameter. So we say that is an option. I don't think we ended up making
it. That's not the...
Yeah, we made it an option, not a requirement. So... No. So it is unlikely, at least in today's technology and how their coverage works, that they will co-locate small cell facilities in the near future. 5 years from now, you're going to hear me say something different probably. But right in the near future, they're not co-locating, and PSC, for example, doesn't want them to be co-locating. I know you're not PSC area, but...
PSC told us they won't do it either. They only want to deal with one carrier per pole.
Yep. So, and so when you're dealing with the equipment boxes, do we have the... Yeah, so if you take a look at this one, what I was looking for was the Verizon one, the one I don't like. So decorative light standard, but if you look here, they've popped the equipment internal. But look at that equipment box compared to the man.
Yeah.
Right, and that is true. I mean, Verizon sent me a picture of an actual, with a man outside, we were just talking about, you know, assume the man 6 feet tall, that box is 5.5 feet. So, again, I'm 5'3". Imagine a pole box my height.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's a pretty big base. And what they're not showing is diameter, but yes, the diameter is going to be pretty big as well. So that'll have ADA problems, that'll have sidewalk clearance problems. So there are advantages to saying, you know what, we're okay with exterior equipment. There's a good... Oh, that's the picture I was talking about. So look at the man compared to the pole. It didn't, that's right, we've had this. you don't feel it looks so bad.
Yeah, it's first on the ground. And then, I mean, in the last meeting, we also talked about street furniture, you know, when you
sure.
require them. We didn't have that in this writing.
So we talk a little bit about street furniture if it's ground mounted. Here's the problem with street furniture. How much street furniture do you want? You still have the same problem, right? You still have it blocking your sidewalks, kind of cluttering up the space. As you're driving, you keep seeing this street furniture. Right. Right. Or trash cans that never get dumped, right? You have extra trash cans. They originally had said, oh, we'll do trash cans. Then you have these trash cans that you have to empty,
yeah.
Right?
But ideally, I'd look at that and say, you know, on the other side of you put it at a street light where you want the community transit stop at, and that's where you also want this thing to be sitting there. And so you've got the combination of a, you know, community transit bench as well as, you know, a light, which is what we want to have at our location for our transit. And, you know, can we do the design? And I know we don't have enough teeth in our code in order to hold those things against them, but that's where I look at and go, okay, what would be the other side of this?
Could we
get some benefit as a public?
So the other problem with street furniture is the distance between the radio and the antenna. And the larger the distance, what I've been told, is the larger the distance, the more frequency they'll have to have additional small cells. Again, I'm not an expert. That's just what they tell me. I don't typically encourage street furniture. Not saying you can't. I know Palo Alto was considering it for a while. It rains here. You know, Palo Alto people are more likely to sit on a bench than rainy Mill Creek. Yeah.
Well, we don't have very many bus stops either. I mean, we have a little bit around Village Green Drive, but there's a bit of a distance between them.
So the other thing is, in San Francisco, they're actually just discussing putting small cells on the bus stops and the bus shelters. So that's... Mm-hmm. So, two problems with that. I think we did incorporate building-mounted facilities here. Yeah. Those are not the preference because of the line of sight. So, if you put it under an eave, you might not necessarily get the line of sight, but also think about a building versus a pole. Pole, you get a 360 degrees. On a building, you're not going to get that. They're going to need more. Here's the other thing. They convinced the FCC that the city basically has to rent their poles for next to nothing. So popping it and having to lease from a landlord, now you're talking $2,000 a month versus $270 per pole per year. Right? Huge difference. So the FCC
one
is...
one contract that you're dealing with versus 85
right. Right. Exactly. So the FCC has made it clear your right-of-way is for the usage of small cells as well. And the preference of building mounted, we could build that. I don't think it's really going to do much. So I get that, and I think, well, one of the things is we don't allow them to build new power poles, right? They can exchange an existing wooden pole for another wooden pole, so PUD can swap out and put a new one in. But we discourage new poles, and what you're describing would be an absolute new pole. I will also say that as much as we're going to try to get them to look as close to what we want them to be as possible and be uniform, they're not committing to that in any city I've worked with so far. They have kind of their variations and different needs. T-Mobile, and I think T-Mobile actually has the nicest design, has one box. It's about this big, really, and that's all it is. No equipment boxes, no antennas, everything's in it. It would be ideal if everybody did that, but they don't. So then we have Verizon that primarily uses panel antennas, so box antennas, and an equipment box. Then you have AT&T. They primarily use cylindrical antennas and an equipment box. So we are going to be meeting with them and trying to get them to try to get a design that looks fairly similar for each of them, but I've yet to see a design that works 100% for each of them. Now, here's the thing, right? Let's take a look at this Kent one. I think we can get, so this is an AT&T design, I think. I think we can get Verizon fairly close to a design like this. T-Mobile won't look like this, but it also won't look worse than this based on their current design because it'll just be that one box and it'll be as close to the, what they want to do is as close to the light standard as possible. No, it would be basically right where the Cobra head is. So they're not all going to look alike as much as we try. I agree. And I think that's something we can take back to them and say, hey, can you raise that equipment box? Can you get as close to the light standard as possible? Part of it may be a PUD issue. I know that on wooden poles, there is an issue there with the PUD and PSE. But maybe not necessarily on a light standard. Yep. Well, and also the concrete poles that you have are not hollow, so they're going to have to replace them. I can answer that.
There's a next step slide that talks about the process, but
yes. We've got a slide on it. So, yes. So, we're going to take amendments from both you today, internally, based on the conversations we've had, carriers, PUD, and then come back. We have a second work session in March. We're going to brief the council in between, and then a public hearing planned in April.
So, you don't need us to adopt by title only
draft? Nope. This was purely to get your comments and daylight this to you. Yeah. So, and just to kind of start wrapping up a little bit, rather than going page by page on the rest of this, are there questions that currently exist? We've covered a lot of pieces already. What we did is we're going to try to adopt these ideal poll standards, right? But if we don't, because we can't get to one, or if we, in more likely the case, we don't in time for the council meeting, we have these generic design standards. So if you're going to build a small cell, here are the parameters we put on you. And the third piece, by the way, is those would apply if they can show they cannot use the design that we have adopted in the design manual. So here's our generic things. You've got to have it flush-mounted, meaning no more than 6 inches off the pole, or 12 inches, depending on the type of the pole. Your equipment box can only be X size, things like that. So we've got those in here. And then we have a process on 270, which deals with what happens if you want to put in a new pole. What do you have to prove? So we deal with what do you have to prove for a new pole, what do you have to prove for a decorative pole, and this idea of the creation of a concealment element design.
Small wireless utilities
mounted or strung between two existing utility poles,
and utility poles can be
light standard or anything else. So that and the definition. So are we saying they can go and string this between two light poles?
No. 8. Strand mounted facilities are prohibited on non-wooden poles. D8.
Only be the wood one. It'd be the only wooden ones.
So there are times where you do get a wooden light pole. You may not have very few of them, but they would be allowed there if PUD would allow it. But those already have existing overhead wire lines.
Well, there's some wooden poles in the annexed areas. Down 3rd Avenue, there's a few wooden poles around there. Not a whole lot, but there are some.
You mentioned the 6 inches. I thought that. Why is 6 inches the definition of flush?
Great question. So it has to do with the National Electric Safety Code. And I'm saying that with a pause because it might be the National Electric Code. So it's either the NEC or the NESC. And so there are two different sets of rules. So it's one of the two of them requires that that there is space between a pole and equipment so that you can have a pole climber. There you go. So that's why we define flush mount. So I believe it's 4.6 inches. We've defined flush mounted as 6 inches because we're not going to fault somebody if they were off by an inch or so. That's why we use 6 inches. There are times, I think in this code, we put 12 inches, and the reason is mainly because the antenna's up above. You can't see it on this picture, but they need to sometimes tilt the antennas. If you tilt the antenna, you'll end up with more than 6 inches between the antenna and the pole. Also, there's times where they side mount, so particularly on... So a pole like this, let's pretend it's this pole. It really wouldn't work here, but you could see a little bit of a side mount with a cylindrical antenna to the side. This isn't the right example for that. I don't know that I have a good example of a side-mounted one. But there are times where you might see a side-mounted one, which would be more than 6 inches off the pole. Further questions?
So in the time that you've been... dealing with just cell in general, you mentioned a couple times, I'm not asking you to predict the future, but how quickly are things evolving? Like, if 3, 4, 5 years, is this likely to be vastly different?
Yes. In my personal opinion, yes. They haven't figured out 5G. And I've been dealing with some of these same design standards for 2 years with the carriers, and 2 years ago, oh, these are great. And I get comments today of, well, our designs have changed. Or what the recent comment I got last week is, we really can't shroud or tint 5G antennas. We can tint them. We can't paint 5G antennas. So you can't use the word paint because we can't do that, and we can't necessarily shroud them. So it's just like they don't know what's going to happen, what a strand mount is going to look like. We're just starting to get into that realm. Absolutely. So I don't think it's going to be the same. Further questions for me, comments? My pleasure. We need to discuss that. I'm not necessarily needed at every meeting, so we'll talk internally whether or not I'm needed and if I'm booked at another meeting. Thank you. Thank you. All right. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
Well, the only thing I would like to report to you is the City Council last Tuesday night considered the code amendments that you had recommended regarding code enforcement issues. We had quite a good discussion, a robust discussion about that. The council has asked us to make a very small revision to include one of the factors as far as what is a junk vehicle. There were we had listed four, and they would have to have three of the four. The council has asked us to add tabs back in as one of the things that could be considered. You still have to have three of the five instead of three of the four. And that way it gives the city one more tool that we can use, but nobody could get towed just for having expired tabs on a car in the driveway. So we are revising that ordinance right now, and we will be taking that back to the council as soon as next Tuesday if we can get it on the agenda. That's our hope. It's a pretty busy agenda, though, so we'll see. But it was well-received, I think, by the council, and hopefully that will be adopted in our code very soon. So that's the only thing I really have to report. Do you have any, Sherry?
Oh, actually, I do.
That's Michael. Oh, and then Sherry has some.
Should I go now or wait?
Yeah, I'm done.
Okay, the only thing I wanted to say about the training, thank you to the people that have done the training and the people that haven't. I did send out an email with an in-person training if you prefer it. Okay? Unfortunately,
I think
a lot of people that
haven't
heard. Because I know you guys
fall
into it.
And then one last thing. I just want to recognize Alana. She's not here anymore, and Sherry. They worked really hard. This was a big lift. I mean, we had a lot of good discussion, and we found a few little typos and stuff. But this took a lot of work to take something that a boilerplate document that doesn't apply to our code at all and then sort of mold something that fits into our system, and to take a lot of the work that had been done in the past from the commission and the council as far as, and to sort of mold it the same kind of a way so the staff would be able to implement it. There's a lot of work went into that. And so there's some more work to be done, but I just want to really, my hat's off to Sherry and to Alana. They worked really hard on this over the last month. That ends my for the good of the order.
I'm good.
I think the motion to adjourn.
Second, all in favor?
Aye. My nears and fars.
They're almost the same.
They are. They're like